One of the things, and that this is really, really hard to think back, like be in the mindset, was just like, this was 2015 summer, and it wasn't really, certainly in the UK, Amazon definitely wasn't really deemed a tech company back then. It was like a retailer in the UK. It was just moving its offices from Slough, which is outside of London, not a good place to be as a grad, truthfully, to like a cool office in like the hipster part of London. And so it was just not really a thing, but as with so many things, there was some serendipity, and just a recruiter who I'd met studying was just like, oh, they've actually just, you know, they're moving to London. They think they're going to be able to start hiring grads now. So like, look, the jobs that they didn't used to accept grads for, they didn't have a grad scheme at the time. This was, and I joined literally 2 weeks after the first ever Amazon Prime Day, which was crazy. So it was just like really getting going. And so it was kind of, that was one thing, was like, wow, this is, it's going to be interesting. But I knew I wanted to work for a company where you were building, creating, doing, rather than only in professional services. That was one of my key takeaways.
Hey everybody, welcome to the GMI Rocket Show. Today's episode number 80. I'm your host, Roman Zelchenko. I am a former immigration attorney turned entrepreneur, the founder of Laborless, co-founder of Laborless, which is an immigration tech startup that automates H-1B visa compliance, and also the founder of GMI Rocket, which is a digital marketing agency for the immigration and mobility industry, and also, of course, which brings you this show. I'm really excited today. Our guest is coming to us, joining us actually in the US, but he's typically from the UK. Our guest today is Paul Bennett, who is the CEO and co-founder of a company called PerchPeak. So PerchPeak is basically a relocation platform that's super focused on the assignee, on the person who's relocating. And so it enables, you know, companies and other users to help move an individual along their relocation journey, but you know, it was really centered towards the experience for the individual in terms of them having access to documentation, in terms of them understanding where they are in the process and other pieces of the puzzle. I'm really excited to discuss this. I love the fact that companies are moving into a sort of user-first or user-centric point of view. So I really love that. So without further ado, please welcome Paul. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to our conversation.
As am I, Roman. Thanks for such a gracious introduction. Put it better myself.
Whenever I do that, I sometimes worry that perhaps misspoke or said something wrong.
No, you nailed it, buddy. You absolutely nailed it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being here. And, you know, again, I'm excited that you're actually in the States, just because I'm obviously typically it is quite
late for your show.
Quite late for my show. Yeah. So I appreciate you and I appreciate your time. So I know you are here right now, but you are originally, you were born in the UK, you grew up in the UK. And I do typically love to start off these episodes just kind of getting to know the guests, you know, and like getting to know your life and sort of how you spent your early days in your life, things like that. And so tell me if you can a little bit, like, you know, who was Paul? As a younger kid, you know, were you the lemonade stand or selling baseball cards kind of kid or video games or, you know, studious? Like, tell me a little bit about that.
I would say I'd love to be one of those people who was just like, you know, I was running the school tuck shop age 4 and turned my first profit age 5. But sadly, that wasn't quite the case for me. I was far too busy generally just playing as much sport as possible. That was really, was very fortunate to have a very sport and fun-filled upbringing, to be honest. I'm very, very grateful to my parents for that. So pretty much anything under the sun, and I think probably early memory, you can't really see it on a video, but I'm relatively tall. I'm 6'4", and I was having a growth spurt age 13 or so, and my back just suddenly became out, and like, it was nothing serious, but went to the physio and he was like, oh, how much sport are you playing? Like, I was like, well, in the morning, lunchtime at school, after school, and then in the evening. So it was pretty intense growing up, but heaps of fun. So many of my best friends are still from various sporting teams growing up. So that was, I would say, the dominant theme of my childhood. And then, I would say, like, when I think back to my childhood, it's just always like various sports teams, various pitches, and traveling around the the country, UK is relatively small, so it's not that big a deal, but playing games.
When you were that age, I mean, I'm assuming this is grade school, kind of, you know, through teenage years. Did you want to be a professional athlete? Like, was that kind of your life goal?
It's a great question. Yeah, definitely at the time. I remember, ironically now, because something you can tell through video is that I'm very skinny, so I would have been a terrible rugby player. But back before it became, everyone started to grow up, I wanted to be a professional rugby player. I know that's not a super popular sport in the States, but it's a very, it's like American football without the pads. So I wanted to do that. And then I actually ended up playing a lot of field hockey and tennis and cricket. The obligatory soccer, which I think everyone plays. I'm trying to use soccer for your American audience, so I hope you appreciate that. But yeah, I definitely wanted to be a professional. And then it's funny, looking back, it was probably around the age of sort of 15 or so, you were like, okay, this is not good enough at any of these sports. And like the amount of commitment you have to put in there. Still, it was, I think if you play sports as a kid, most people fantasize about like, I don't know, playing at the World Cup or winning Wimbledon or something similar.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's cool. And I think there's a lot of drive. I mean, to your point, you know, you made that decision. It's possible that you would have, if you made the opposite decision, you could have gotten to a place where you were, you know, who knows? But
yeah,
the point is that you, your early days, like you kind of put work and put your time and energy towards something that you loved.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. I mean, there are a lot of kids who would hate playing sports, and you, even if they're fully capable physically, you know, so
yeah,
it's great that you focused on what you love. Now, did you, when you kind of around university age, so 16, 17, 18 years old, you obviously, it sounds like, made the decision that, okay, well, I'm not going to be a professional rugby player, professional, you know, athlete, at least then. I mean, first of all, probably not too late still. Who knows?
True. Yeah, let's see.
But you decided that might not be your career path. So what did you then decide? I mean, at that point, you know, were you thinking like, gosh, what do I do with my life? What do I study? Like, what did you do?
I'd say probably I was definitely one of those kids that, let's do two things. So one was sort of first proper-ish taste was, did a lot of sports coaching growing up. So that was great. I'm sort of, could just stay and do this, but they have this great scheme in the UK called like the Young Enterprise Scheme, which is kind of like towards the end of school when you're like 17, 18, kind of a structured program that encourages students to start a business and provide some mentorship. And anyway, it made it really easy to get together with a bunch of friends and start a business. And I just remember it's quite a lot of us in our company that just absolutely loved it. And it was me and one other guy predominantly driving it. And at the time, it was a couple of things I remember particularly loving. One was just the ideation process of just like, particularly in that environment, what problem shall we even focus on? But then we ended up selling hand sanitizers because it was, ironically, it would have been an amazing business. It's sort of COVID came around. I was like, I should dig out the old couple of boxes of hand sanitizers I still have in the garage. But, but at the time there was, a lot of, bird flu in the UK and there was a real shortage of, particularly good quality spray hand sanitizers. And we'd read some research that some people preferred spray. Anyway, it was enough for us to go on and we were like, let's go with Aardvark. So it was the top of all the lists. And anyway, and so really loved that process. And then did it for a year. And I think the thing that I really loved, it was easy enough to bulk buy some hand sanitizers, get them branded, and then you were trying to sell it. And that was the time where I just thought, wow, this is amazing. We were just really lean on our age and just beg supermarkets to say, do you mind if we stand outside and try and sell these things, go to fairs, etc. And that process, I just absolutely fell in love with like the sort of early stage startup hustle. That was when I started thinking, okay, like entrepreneurship can be really fun and particularly sales could be really fun. And almost what I loved about it was it, because it was a bit of a, it gave you an excuse almost to do things you probably wouldn't do in normal life. It was, oh, well, we're doing this program, we have to go out and get sales and we have to create marketing videos and stuff like that. So it really forced you to just be a bit daring and just like to get out there. So I'll share one of the marketing videos we created afterwards, but it was very, very good fun. So that was actually quite like a prominent, and the sort of final thing on that was, I remember very good mate Tom, who was, I was doing a lot of it with, just spending hours on the phone discussing things and like he's still a very good mate, but we don't spend hours on the phone anymore, trust me. So it's kind of like that moment where you're like, wow, this is so fun just noodling on ideas. So that was probably like the first time I was like, wow, being an entrepreneur could be really, really fun. Then went to uni, as we would say in the UK, or college for the American audience, and was like, okay, I don't really know what I'm doing. And my dad was like, you should get some proper work experience. Like, unless you want to be a coach of anything, then your sports coaching hasn't been very useful so far. And then I went and got an internship at an investment bank, which was
Credit Suisse, I think, right?
Very well researched. Exactly. Yeah. At Credit Suisse, which was another, I guess, pivotal time in my life. From I did a lot of growing up. That it's a 10-week program, but it was a really, really interesting time.
And now, did you do that after your first year of uni, or was that sort of later on in your career?
So I did it in my second year summer. So first year summer, I did work at a very small bank. First year in the UK, it's a funny one. There aren't that many formal programs you can apply to. So you're sort of scrambling around to try and find something. And then it was, but what I did do was, what the banks have is they do these things called spring weeks, where they try and, I don't want to say like prey on unsuspecting first years like me, but they basically try to be like, if we're the first people to offer like a formal path for university students, we can kind of get them in before anyone else. So I was like, oh, that sounds good. And the spring week was in my first year. And that was honestly one of the most fun weeks of my life. It's a week. They're walking you through all the different things that an investment bank does. It's 9 to 5. It's drinks and boat cruises every evening. You're having inspiring talks. They're making it seem like it's the best thing ever. And then at the end of this week, they're like, oh, do you want to come and do an internship next year? And you're like, oh my God, I get to avoid having to apply for internships. This is amazing. Like, sign me up. And met loads of really cool people. Was in London for the first time. Was like, I'm a big city baller now. So it was like, anyway, so needless to say, then started the internship in second year summer. And it was just, like investment banking. It just wasn't really for me. I loved aspects of it, but it was definitely a lot of busy work, some crazy hours, a lot of red lines for red line sake, truthfully. Right. But it was a very, very good experience doing that stuff.
So I'm curious, because my first internship as well during university was an investment bank as well, my first year, one that doesn't exist anymore, Bear Stearns.
Oh, nice. Wow. And casualty.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of grew up, if you will, in terms of I worked in retail and whatever beforehand, but that was my first kind of real kind of paycheck.
Yeah.
And I still credit the summers that I spent there. And then when I was in law school, and of course, after law school, I worked in some corporate environments. I always fancied myself somebody more entrepreneurial, I think a little bit, create or whatever it is. But nevertheless, I worked in these environments. And one of the things that I credit to those environments is, honestly, just straight up learning how to be organized.
Yes.
Because when you step into a corporate environment, you have access to this drive, and you have to look, when you're saving things, you have to save them with the correct naming. And a lot of times it felt like red lines or red tape just for the sake of it. But I'm curious, what were some of the takeaways that you had from that experience? And I say this specifically because, this is a podcast where I talk to business founders very often, right?
Yeah.
And I always hear, and I thought this myself too, like, oh, well, I can't start a business. I'm a corporate person. Like, I've never started a business. I've always worked in a big company. And if someone tells that, I try to spin it the other way and say, fine, but you've learned all these really great things along the way that will be really beneficial to you. So I'm curious, what are some of the things that you took away from that as your first, like, quote unquote, corporate experience?
It's such a great question, because the weird amounts, considering it's only one summer, particularly as you say, just dated with like just how to do things to quite a high standards. And I think particularly in professional services, the main thing, obviously they're getting paid a ridiculous amount of money, so everything has to be super high quality. And so that quality bar is something that I think is, it leads on to the red lines, which sometimes can get a bit OTT, but really learning what good looks like was, I think, one of the main things. And that was amazing. Specifically in that world, was Excel. It was so, so valuable. And just being forced to use that hour and hours a day and get shortcuts down and just still use a lot of that stuff today. And so that was super valuable and actually stood me in good stead when I went to Amazon. And then now it's like so useful, just being not fluent in Excel, good in Excel. And then the third thing I think that it really taught me positively was that you can actually influence things quite a lot. And particularly in this instance, there were eight of us on our floor and eight interns, this is. And see, they hope that five or six of the interns are going to take offers at the end of it if they made them. And it turned out that six out of eight of us were going to say no, and they got wind of this. And then they started like really making our experience much, much better. So it's kind of like, that was quite an interesting one in the sense of like, particularly if you drive things the right way and you present data, then you can actually influence change, even in quite like a rigorous environment from there. And so I feel to your point around, we see this all the time now. It's like, we just see it when even when we're hiring people from great like professional services backgrounds, they're just, the quality of their work is typically high. And to your point, I think not that it's easier, but the majority of starting a business, right, is just executing and doing, and that's kind of that like 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration idea. And it's like, if you have great skills that have been taught for you by other people really at their cost, that's amazing, and it's really hard to replicate. So I think it's like an amazing, amazing background to start something up at. And that we'll probably come on to speak about investing later, but like investors love it as well, because they're like, this person actually knows how to get stuff done. The flip side of it, and the downside that I certainly found, and I think is replicated like relatively early in your career, and why I quite quickly thought professional services probably aren't for me, is that I found that, and this is the thing for me that is difficult when you think of entrepreneurship, is really professional services, a lot of the time there's a very clear idea of what good looks like. And so when you're given your bit of work, certainly as an intern, but even as first, second, third year analyst, it's normally quite a clear brief. And the person giving you the work is normally, when you give it back to them, is normally going the equivalent of, that's an A star or a B or whatever, or that's a 7 out of 10. They have quite a clear idea of what they're looking for often, and it's how well do you match up to that. Whereas I think that's the sort of thing with entrepreneurship, particularly in the early days, is you're really having to create stuff out of nothing. And that's not necessarily what you get in those worlds, because particularly early in your career, you're sort of more encouraged to just do the work you're given to an exceptionally high standard. So it's amazing for that, but it doesn't necessarily foster that creativity of, okay, we don't have a solution for this problem at all. You need to sort of magic it up out of thin air.
Yeah, and that's just interesting, right? A lot of folks come out of, you know, university or even maybe an MBA program and want to go work at a startup because they think that, oh, that's exciting. And it, for sure, I mean, listen, if you're a creative person and you get a kick out of getting a blank slate and them saying you create a solution for this, you know, it takes a high level of confidence to think that whatever I create is going to be even good enough to consider. And it's certainly a really fun thing. But I guess, you know, you step into a role, you never worked in an organization that forces you to work within boundaries.
Yeah.
And there's value in it. And so that's why I really asked this question. You know, for someone who thinks, if someone is self-aware enough at the ages of 17 through 22 to say, I'm the kind of person who wants to be creative, I want to go out, I feel confident in my decisions, you know, I want to be an entrepreneur, or I want to have, you know, more flexibility with my work product. If someone knows that well enough, I would actually tell those people, great, during the time that you're at uni, go work in the place that is going to feel as constricted as can be, because the things you won't have to do it full time for the rest of your life. You already know that.
Yeah.
But then the things that you get out of it, what we're talking, will help you more effectively, you know, deliver these things out of nothing, you know?
Yeah. I 100% agree with you on that front. And it's chiefly, if I think about, even, you know, we've had some summer interns at Perch Peak, and I'm sure they've learned a lot, but I guarantee they won't have learned a lot as much as they did in that environment, which I think is sometimes countered, certainly in terms of like tangible skills of that they can pretty much use anywhere. And I would definitely agree with that assertion that if you feel like you have that drive and creativity innate, sometimes that can get dulled if you stay somewhere for like 15 years or something. But if that's innate, that's amazing. Get the skills, and then you're still quite like, you're never too old. Like, what most founders are in their 40s whenever they're really successful ones. So it's like, it's just incredibly useful to have a great environment for learning, which is those places before starting out on yourself. And then you know how to, because that's the other, and we're sort of jumping ahead a little bit here, but I just will never forget the time of like the first days of just doing Perch Peak full time, where you're like, wow, like there's 12 hours in a day, and you're like, what am I going to do? And you're like, there's no meetings, there's no training, and you're kind of like, and that's not like what startups are like, but it's good to have sort of some structured learning, I think, and it's certainly not a blocker to successful companies in any way.
Yeah, no, that's great. And we're definitely going to get into that, because I definitely experienced that myself, you know, realizing, wow, I have to create my own work.
Oh, no. You know? And you're like, wow, like, it's amazing how just busy corporate life is often, where you get kind of get ferried around, and then there's write-ups for meetings, mm-hmm. and then you've got to produce this doc, and there's this presentation, and just the blank slate is a funny moment.
Yeah. Okay. So I love that. So I do want to, you're at Credit Suisse as an intern, you know, you spent some time there, you graduated from university, and I think you studied, if I remember correctly, like philosophy, politics, and economics. Is that right?
Yes.
Because, and I remember that specifically because I was a financial economics major.
Oh, nice.
And I ended up staying at college for 5 years. And then I double majored in my last year in what we call philosophy, politics, and law. So
oh, nice.
your degree was like a combined version
yeah.
of the two concentrations I had. But you then, I know that you went to work eventually at Amazon and, you know, in sort of in a corporate environment. But one of the things that you and I talked about before that I really want to dive into a little bit is you ended up traveling the world, right?
Yeah.
And it sounds like before you took this job at Amazon, but after you graduated from uni. So can you talk a little bit about that? I went to travel. I did the kind of Euro trip, if you will, before, between college and law school. Was that the idea for you that like, okay, let me take a quick trip before I take a corporate job? Or was it, I just graduated university, I'm just going to buy a one-way ticket and see where life
goes? Yeah. So it links into that, the Credit Suisse internship. So I did a three-year course. There's a weird thing in the UK where and this is going to sound so pathetic for an American audience, but like our university fees were going up from £3,000 a year to £9,000 a year. So obviously by US standards, that's small potatoes. You're like, get over it, Paul. But anyway, for us, I originally wanted to take out a year up before going to study, but I was like, well, the fees are going to be tripled. I may as well go and take time out afterwards. And so I'd always like, love traveling, and then had a super hectic second year summer working at Credit Suisse, and had some time for it, but not too much. And the good, another truthfully calling a spade a spade, good thing about the corporate internships is they tend to pay well as well. So and I was super fortunate to like bunk on my brother's floor, and I was working basically every minute of the day, so didn't really spend much. It was like I had some savings, had just like gone through 18 years of school, 3 years of studying. I was like, look, this is just really a great time to just travel, meet new people, explore the world. And was fortunate that my brother, who's a few years older than me, had taken a year out before uni, taken a year out after uni, done a couple of years at a job, and then taken another year out. So he sort of set the precedent that this would be a fun thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so it was just like, look, we'll go, we'll travel, we'll start in South America, and was lucky to go all over the place, truthfully. And was just at the time sort of thinking, like, this is the best opportunity ever to have some savings, be able to travel, literally have no responsibilities / kind of, not that like a career break is ever or is increasingly rarely seen as a bad thing, but you know, once you start, it's like it's just too good an opportunity when you have no responsibilities. No one's going to be like, oh my god, you took a year out post college,
right?
You not care about your career. You know, they're like, oh, you should have been there grinding. So it was like it was just too good an opportunity, and that was definitely another special year in my life. Just did a lot of, I think, growing up and at university, but also during the internship, and then just meeting so many people. I was traveling by myself most of the time for 9 months, and just meeting so many people, particularly a lot of people who were on career breaks, which was fun. And you just sort of like probably met like a more diverse group of people in that 9 months than like, yeah, the 19 years beforehand or whatever. So it was just a really, really special time, and again, hugely privileged to be in a place to do it. And then eventually got to a time where it was like, okay, like savings aren't lasting forever, should think about getting a job. And then sort of one thing led to another, and I was sort of hopped back home to find mid London and start working at Amazon.
I want to learn about how you, you know, found this job and why Amazon and that whole process. Before I do, I'm curious, you know, you said you met a lot of people, you know, throughout your travels, especially folks on career breaks. Do you, I mean, are there any sort of, is there an instance or anything where you thought to yourself, like, wow, this has been a really life-changing experience. Like, was there anything that really changed you profoundly during that travels, especially since it was, I presume, your first time for an extended period of time traveling around the world?
Yeah, it's a great, it's a really, really good question. And obviously, like, there's so many amazing moments, but I think probably the time where I felt like, wow, this is so interesting, was this guy I met called Liam, who I traveled with for a few months. And he was like a 29-year-old classic Aussie, kind of just like full of beans, like loved getting on the beers, just like so stereotypical. But I just remember, like, I was 21 at the time, and spending 3 months, and we did like just so much hiking together, and just, he just seemed so wise, because he was just so like, yeah, I really just did a job for a few years because I wanted to save up for this big trip. He was also on a year-long trip. And I was like, wow, that is awesome, that he's just geared his whole life, age 29, towards doing something fun for himself. And like, I was at the time, I was sort of thinking, oh, great, I'm having some fun now, and then I'm going to be career for the rest of my life. And it was just, he was just like, wow, this guy is just knows what he enjoys in life and goes from there. And that was kind of so, yeah, for a 21-year-old, I was like, oh, wait, this isn't the end. Once I stop traveling, you actually do have a lot of optionality. And that's the cool thing when you travel, right, is you meet a bunch of people who chosen their life path rather than have it chosen for them. And yeah, again, it was sort of fitting into, which is quite a big mantra for me now, which is like, you nearly always have more options than you think. It's very easy to feel trapped, and often understandably so, but there are often more options than you think. And he was a big driver of that mentality early on.
That's awesome. That's such a great insight. And also, I mean, I think that lends itself to being an entrepreneur and understanding that you always have more options than you think, and there's always a plan B, plan C, plan D, even if you're not aware of it. But I would say for you, I mean, listen, as a 21-year-old, the fact that you were aware of this and made this connection is pretty cool. Like that, yeah. you had the maturity, you know, to sort of pick up on that and have it impact you.
Yeah. Well, and I think as always with these things, it's easy to sort of look backwards and sort of stitch together a bit of a path, but at the time, it was just so, yeah, it was like, wow, like, so lucky to have this experience now. And also the other good thing about solo traveling in general is that, having been through quite an institutional upbringing, school, then university, you're basically told what to do most of the time, right? It's internships, you're definitely told what to do all of the time. Whereas here, you're like, literally, you have to completely drive whatever you want. And that's also a good learning, right? To be like, what do I want to do? I can't just sit back and that sort of, drive of like, I've got to own my whole day here and figure out what I like doing and who I want to hang out with. So yeah, that was, and again, I think just super privileged, don't want to be like snooty about it, but people often are like, oh, is that going to impact my career? And certainly in startup lands, I think whenever you see people who take career break, you're generally like, oh, I just want to talk about it. Where did you go? What was your cool experiences? Trade stories. So it's yeah, very, very lucky, great learning, and miss it a lot, to be honest, because it's an amazing time in life.
Well, I mean, listen, you're working out of, or you're, I shouldn't say that, but you're in Colorado right now.
Exactly.
You know, well, in a sense, you're traveling. So that's awesome.
And that's been another huge, awesome change. We'll come on to it. I ended up spending 6 weeks in Argentina at the time, which was a huge, huge learning experience as well. And just thinking, I love this city. And at the time, it seemed like such a pipe dream, because you're thinking about how your career might play out. And at the time, you're thinking, it's going to be really hard to get a job in Buenos Aires. You know, it's just at the time, you're thinking, that is like, I'm running through possible career options that I was just not on. Whereas now, like, I'm heading back there in a month for 5 months, which would be amazing.
And wow.
That's super fortunate. So, incredibly fortunate. And the way the cards are falling is pretty cool.
So let's talk a little bit about your eventually afterwards, you know, after this sounds like a fantastic trip, you decided, okay, I gotta get a job again the very least to make some money, maybe for your next trip, whatever it might be. And you were applied and found a job at Amazon. Tell me a little bit about, as far as I understand, you know, this sort of whole experience of moving back to the UK and kind of starting to work at Amazon started to introduce you to the world of, you know, relocation in a sense, or at least, you know, having this international journey as you were applying for a job. So what was that experience like? Did anything come out of that for you? Or was it just, I'm going to apply for the job, move back to the UK and then start working?
I think one of the things, and that this is really, really hard to think back, like be in the mindset, was just like, this is 2015 summer. And it wasn't really, certainly in the UK, Amazon definitely wasn't really deemed a tech company back then. It was like a retailer in the UK. It was just moving its offices from Slough, which is outside of London, not a good place to be as a grad, truthfully, to like a cool office in like the hipster part of London. And so it was just not really a thing. But as with so many things, there was some serendipity, and just a recruiter who I'd met studying was just like, oh, they've actually just, you know, they're moving to London. They think they're going to be able to start hiring grads now. So like, look, the jobs that they didn't used to accept grads for, they didn't have a grad scheme at the time. And I joined literally 2 weeks after the first ever Amazon Prime Day, which was crazy. So it was just like really getting going. And so it was kind of, that was one thing, was like, wow, it's going to be interesting. But I knew I wanted to work for a company where you were building, creating, doing, rather than only in professional services. That was one of my key takeaways. So kind of was lucky enough to get this job. And you could tell, it was quite funny, because you could tell through the interview process, they weren't really sure how to interview a grad, because they were like, Amazon has a very well-defined interview process, which is like really digs deep into your experience and what you've done historically. And I've just had all these people going, you really haven't done much, have you? And I was like, I'm a grad, so like, well, I don't know what you're expecting. Like, I don't have like a massive job history. So anyway, eventually got there, as you say, moved to London. Moved to London. That was as you can imagine, a very stressful process, and was just like, so much to do. You're doing it outside of like getting up to speed with your job. Just everything was moving with friends, so you're trying to coordinate all of them, one of whom was in the US at the time, so you're trying to like do video tours with him. And it was just, that was such a messy process, and that was probably the first like lick of, wow, this moving process sucks. Wasn't necessarily at the time we should start a business in this space. It was more of a kind of a, wow, this process really sucks, like think about that a little bit more and go from there.
And so it's kind of one of those things where you had an experience, it impacted you, maybe you tucked it away somewhere.
Yeah.
Subconsciously, perhaps, right?
Yeah, subconsciously. Yeah. Exactly. And you sort of think at the time, because I remember whilst I was traveling, I was thinking I might try and start a business straight away. I was like, so I had a bunch of ideas floating around.
Can you share what some of those were?
Yeah.
I'm curious.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
do you remember them?
I do. I remember vividly. One of them was, bizarrely, which is funny, I remember I'd been on a holiday and been to a craft center and like had like hand painted a t-shirt with a colorful penguin, and which is funny given like a colorful parrot is now our logo, but was like, oh, this could be quite like a fun business to start, almost linking back to the experience I had with the hand sanitizers, where it's like it'd be easy enough to get some stock. People seem to be into this like hipster sort of curated t-shirt. You just produce them yourself and then go out and sell them. And then various reasons, I was like, they looked horrible, so it was probably not going to be a good idea. But it was like, okay, that could be quite like a classical business, if that makes sense. Kind of like you get your stock, you go try and sell it at a markup, you have kind of like, it could be good learning, but obviously very expensive and cash flow stuff. Then another one I had, perhaps unsurprisingly, given my childhood, was a sports booking app, which still is much better than it was, but still isn't necessarily solved. Like if you just want to find somewhere to play tennis or to go to the gym or to play five-a-side football. At the time, it was like still very much you just have to go on websites and be like, tennis courts near me or tennis courts in Southwest London or whatever it might be. Right. So that was like kind of like that. And then I thought, has a lot of dependencies, and that was one. And then the other one that was actually quite related to what we ended up doing with Perch Street was doing video viewings for people relocating to London or moving to London, really, because obviously when you're from abroad, and my friend will experience this, it's who I was moving with, if you're not actually there, it's really hard to see the place, but you kind of often want to have a place for when you arrive. So anyway, that was the third idea. But I sometimes look back and think, oh my God, like could have been a different story. Could have been a different podcast moment for sure.
Yeah. I mean, those are all great ideas. I think I saw some ads for, if I remember the name correctly, I think there's an app called Court Pals.
Yeah.
Where you can find someone to play tennis with. And it's it's brilliant, but yeah, that's hard. Cause you, like you said, you got to get it. Hundreds of thousands and thousands of people. It's hard. I mean, it's definitely tough.
One of those ideas that, and so often this is the case, like, and this is something I learned a lot at Amazon, was an amazing idea, but just so many dependencies, because you've got to find the supply, and you've got to get them signed up, and you've got to get them to somehow keep their availability live. So that's hard. Then you've got to build the supply of people who are interested in using the product. And it's like, you know, so you've got to have a court pal to do it with you. So very challenging as well. And like, if there's only one of you, it's not a great experience. And then you've got to find a way of making money. And you're kind of like, well, you go to all that effort to collect the supply for everyone. And people are like, well, I'm not that much more willing to book a court through you. You know, I might pay a couple of quid more, but I'm probably not going to pay loads. So it was an interesting sort of one thinking through, like, great idea, but very hard to like execute. So that's true. Like, court pals and stuff of like phenomenal entrepreneurs who are like smashing it rather than like sort of a weedy 21-year-old just hacking away in his garage.
But to your point, you know, the conversation there is the conversation with yourself, just thinking through that is important. So you moved back to London. I guess I can say that because you lived there during your uni years, and you started working at Amazon. Now, at what point did you start thinking to yourself, like, what happened that enabled this idea for Perch Peak to come to life? If there was an instance, I mean, it could have been.
Yeah. Because I would say it definitely wasn't like a light bulb switching and here we are today. Because it sort of had the fire. I can just hear there's a massive thunderstorm going on in Colorado right now. It's properly mental. Whoa. Like properly mental. You know, it's like quite unnerving when you can hear so much thunder, then you're like, whoa. So it definitely wasn't a light bulb moment. I'd sort of been rumbling around when first moving to London, as I mentioned, and thinking this is a bit crap. And then a lot of friends were moving to London, having terrible experiences. And then probably the one that, as I got into it more and more, was that Amazon's huge for talent mobility, and so started to have friends moving to Seattle, to Singapore, to Sao Paulo. And actually, before I ended up starting Perch Peak, was like, oh, I want to go live in Seattle or Singapore, but anywhere really. It's like, and how amazing that they're going to make that happen for me, because that's normally difficult, right, to relocate somewhere. It's challenging, and Amazon make it really easy. So people were like staying at the company so they could go live in different places around the world. But the process of getting there was just consistently pretty poor for them, and particularly for sort of like more junior employees who didn't have like super handheld packages. And that was just sort of after seeing that again and again, we started being like, okay, like this moving process is pretty tough, particularly when it comes to finding a home. And so just started noodling with a very old friend who eventually became my co-founder, Ollie, and he had a bit of a background in real estate. And so we actually started off life as, okay, why is the process of finding a home when moving so tough? And then we went through various things and eventually ended up with where we are today. But that was the sort of first instance, was like just seeing the same problem again and again. And then we started thinking, okay, what aspects of this problem could we solve? And then sort of same core problem, and then just evolution of solution over the last 4-ish years now, actually, even though we've only been live for a couple.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, it sounds like the crux of the idea came from seeing assign, you know, people relocating, some sort of challenges in their experience and thinking, how can I solve it for them?
Exactly.
The thinking isn't how can I solve it for the company? Although, of course, if you make the process great for people moving, you are solving a problem for the company. You're solving the problem of people quitting because it's not a bad or like hating it and wanting to move back home and not completing their assignment. The focus there is on the person moving.
And 100% did not know that they were called assignees back then. That's for sure. So good catch from you. It was very much just like consumers. And we started life just because, and this is, I think, it's really hard to think back now that I've been in the industry for a while. Like people, even when you hear of people relocating and friends relocating, and you see it all the time, you're not necessarily that aware of the fact that there is this whole industry that often supports that. And particularly for more junior employees. So even though it was happening all the time, you don't necessarily associate it with global mobility. I don't think I'd heard of that term until 2 years in, and we started looking at corporate, like going B2B rather than B2C. I think did stand us in good stead that we were from the start thinking about our own experience sucked, friends' experience sucked. What could we possibly do about this to help the person relocating get a better experience? And it's so funny you say that, because I was literally just on a call earlier today and was just sharing some slides. And we normally refer to our customers as movers or relocators. And they were like, oh yeah, you should not refer to them as, well, people won't understand them as movers. They'll think that's like shipping and hassle Chris in the industry, which is just a funny sort of reminder of where we came from in terms of like the consumer background.
Interesting. Yeah. Because if you're just thinking about the party and what you're solving for them,
Not
maybe necessarily about the vocabulary, but of course the vocabulary is important.
Oh, super important. Yeah.
Not only is it specific, but it also shows that you know what you're talking about. You know the industry, things like that.
Yeah. 100%. 100%.
That's awesome. And so, okay. So you started having this idea, right? And you found your co-founder, Ali, and you guys were starting to work on something. At what point did you decide? I mean, you're at a big company, Amazon, and it's continued to grow. At what point did you decide, I'm going to leave my full-time job and really pursue this, or at least try to go for this full-time?
Yeah. It's such a great question, and one I often speak about with people, particularly like people thinking of starting a business, because I think I probably could have stayed at Amazon even longer in retrospect. But to give this sort of rundown, was working on a really cool project for Amazon that launched in November 2017. Sort of second half of 2017, had been sort of working on producing a prototype with Ollie for like a super basic platform that I don't know where it is anymore, but hopefully consigned to the dustbin of internet history somewhere, not to be found. But anyway, so we launched this, and then we were just really scrappy, going on Facebook, going on the equivalent of Craigslist, trying to find people that were moving and saying, hey, use our platform, we've just launched, dot, dot, dot. So we started to get some users, and was sort of working a tough job during the day, and then still think that's probably the most productive I've ever been, just because you're like, wow, like when you only had like 3 or 4 hours to work on something, you're like locked in. So anyway, it got to a stage where we're like, actually we can get users, maybe it's time to do some fundraising and see if we can raise some money, which I think is, again, looking back, probably quite like a classic entrepreneur's mistake of, oh, the problem here is that we don't have money, when it was like the problem was that our product sucked and we didn't have good channels. So it was, anyway, so we went out and started to like reach out to angel investors and stuff like that. And basically, as that process went on in early 2018, we were like, okay, well, like it looks like we can raise some money here. People are interested in what we're building. We should probably go full time to make that happen, which I think was the right decision. And we got onto an accelerator program, which was awesome. I think in retrospect, though, as soon as we got money, we then completely rebuilt product. And I'm not a coder, so it was kind of like during that time was doing market research, but probably could have kept working another 6 months, truthfully, because it was only once we launched that started to be super, super hectic again. But yeah, it was the investment that sort of drove, like actually almost gave us the confidence that like, well, other people, this is a good idea. Let's actually go full time and make it happen.
And of course, having the investment allows you to, you know, quite literally leave it and have at least some resources for, you know, some runway.
Exactly.
Can you share, I mean, if you're able to, if you're allowed to, can you share what that first sort of investment looked like, or maybe ballpark even?
So it was around 200K.
Okay.
And I remember that is still a lot of money, but at the rent, I'll never forget the first time someone was like, yeah, I'll invest 10K. And you're like, whoa, that's a crazy, crazy moment in your life. So, but that ended up being about 10 or so angel investors and then one sort of early stage accelerator program. But I must have spoken to, I don't know, 200 people, various introductions, because I literally, the start of it was just going on LinkedIn and typing in Angel Investor London and just spamming anyone who could would take a meeting and then going from there. So it was like a properly crazy process, but yeah, sort of got us off to the races.
That's so cool. I love that too, because first of all, everything's relative. You know, now you look back on that and you think, well, maybe it's not a lot of money, and now you would feel so much more confident. But at that time, it was your first time doing it. It was your first business, and to have someone give you some of their hard earned money, I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, really, really crazy. I think whilst it definitely didn't solve all problems, I think the one of the good things was A, confidence, but B, just almost sharpening the focus of like a relatively competitive person. And you're like, wow, I really don't want to like just lose these people's money. I want to make something of it, so to speak, which is not that obviously you'd want to do that anyway, but it was, it was quite a good process from that side of things.
At this point, you've raised some money and you started to build your prototype. You know, we could dig into kind of what that first prototype was, but my big question is, before we get into what the company does today, my big question is, did you launch as something different from what it is today? I mean, I know you said that you've sort of relegated that initial prototype, but like, so it sounds like there was a pivot at some point. So can you just talk a little bit about that? Like, what did you launch as, and why did you eventually say, okay, if we're going to move forward, we can't do X. We now have to shift to Y.
Yeah, absolutely. So we started life really as a home finding platform.
Right.
Really in some ways trying to compete with the equivalents of Zillow for consumers. And our big thing at the time was using machine learning to help you recommend the right home in the right area, which is great. It's obviously super applicable for people relocating because they need to know which area to live. But we initially launched it for consumers at the start of 2019. And I think in that first year, we learned two real things. One was that for people relocating, whilst the search is a core part of the problem, like finding the right home in the right area, there are lots of other things that they were struggling with. And they were like, right, can you help us, you know, with the offer letter, with setting up a bank account, with getting set up the equivalent of the social security, whatever, local gyms, all of these other things. And so then we were like, okay, it doesn't feel like we're solving enough of the problem here to justify them using us. So that was when we started thinking, okay, we should go a bit more extensive and be like a full relocation platform rather than just for like the search. So that was probably pivot number one. And that was very much like a customer-driven pivot. Pivot two was a business model pivot to say a big problem with consumers is that they tend to only relocate once. So you're spending marketing dollars to find the person moving from Seattle to London, and then they move there and you're like, okay, great. Right back to the drawing board. Let's find the next person moving from Chicago or from Mumbai or wherever. So it was quite like a challenging business model. And that was when at the end of 2019, we thought, okay, we've got like a early stage product that we're happy with. We've got, let's start exploring the corporate space because they relocate people all the time. And I actually started speaking to some ex-Amazonian friends. I was like, what was your actual relocation like? What support did you get? And then again, a lot of LinkedIn stalking later, and we ended up in Global Mobility. And that's been a fun time ever since, even though we jumped in early 2020, which is probably the worst timing in history, but it was good for us.
And I want to ask you about that. So if you can summarize, you know, for the listeners and the viewers, at this point, what is Perch Peak today? I mean, explain it to folks who may not know.
Exactly. So we are a platform that guides someone relocating through every step that they need to take when they're moving from point A to point B. So let's say they're moving from Chicago to London. We're going to help them find their house, set up their bank account, get shipping quotes, get their insurance sorted out. How we do that is we combine relocation experts who sort of talk to you through the app with content, partnerships, social nudges based on the data we have about the markets. So we're still very early days, I would say, but like we create this experience where you can both research things yourself within the Purchase Suite platform, but receive expert guidance from your relocation coach whenever you need it. So it's obviously a very emotional time relocating. So like if you're stressed or you just need something unblocked, you've got the support there to open things up. So and depending on exactly that can cut a lot of different ways, but that's like the user experience.
You're helping individuals after. Do you help with domestic moves as well? It doesn't have to be cross-border, does it?
Doesn't have to be cross-border. So it's about 60% domestic, 40% oh, wow. international. Mainly in the US. Obviously, the US domestic market is huge. The outside of the US, it's 70% international, 30% domestic. US, it's like 90% domestic, to be honest. Because also, it's hard to get visas in the US.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, with a domestic move, you know, there's no immigration component. With an international move, there is an immigration component. And I mean, I understand that PurchBeak is not a global visa management platform, but do you have any sort of anything there? Or is it like, okay, once you've gotten your visa and you're legally able to cross, this is where PurchBeak comes in and we can help you manage that whole process?
Exactly. So it's post-visa. Truthfully, for us and the companies we work with so far, most of them have existing providers, or if they don't, we recommend someone in our network to say, look, this is it. And we're often working alongside existing relocation management companies or existing immigration providers, really, because we're saying, look, this is the best tool once you have your visa to like organize everything else. But as you know better than most, immigration is a tough space. So I think it would be a whole nother kettle of fish. We'd rather just partner with the best people for that.
100%. It's like your clients are like, I guess I understand that the person who's using and benefits from the platform is the assignee.
Exactly.
Whether international or domestic. But your clients, I mean, who the entity that you sign an agreement with, I suppose, is that the employer? Is it the RMCs? Is it like what's the business? And I'm asking this specifically because depending on who's listening, I would want someone to say, "Oh, that could be me." Yeah. I'd love to like learn more or whatnot.
Yeah, and that's definitely been one of the nice things for us is that because we're an assignee facing tool, we can partner with anyone that basically has assignees that don't receive this type of help. So when we work alongside relocation management companies, which is most of our business, we're acting normally as a digital DSP, but there are so many employees that just get a lump sum or, you know, don't really get this type of help. So we work a lot with relocation management companies. We work a lot with immigration companies, actually, because it's quite a natural handover to say, great, you've got your visa, PurchBeak will help with the rest. Mm-hmm. And then the third one that we work with is companies directly, because we say, look, okay, you know, we can help your employees soup to nuts. Those are the three main buckets. But we're still super young and finding our feet. So, but RMCs have been great partners for us so far because they have a lot of clients, they have a lot of people relocating that need support. And we're sort of saying, hey, here's great support for them. So it's been a nice match for us in that space.
So I have two questions for you, and I'm gonna ask them in sort of what I think is a chronological order. You know, you started working on this in around, I guess, late 2017, right?
Exactly.
Tinkering and working. It sounds like you launched officially in sort of early 2019, exactly. Right? Which is actually about the amount of time it took for us to launch Laborless. I started working on it in kind of mid to late 2016, thinking about it and talking to people. And we launched in early 2018.
Nice.
But then obviously, you know, you said in like late 2019 is when you started working a little bit more with or started digging into how you can help companies. And then obviously that's when talk started about this thing called COVID.
Yeah.
In early 2020, at least on the US side, that's when we first hit our lockdown. And I think soon thereafter, most of the world shut down. I mean, were you freaking out? I mean, now you're like, you left a job, you started this company that's based on people moving and like borders are closed.
Yeah, it was, I would say, freaking out. And also, we just had pivoted into like the space, and it was just, we'd been to one trade show in December, and we had three trials that were supposed to kick off in March, and obviously they all just got canned. Oh, well, this is sucks. Like, if you can't leave your house, you're definitely not relocating. Like, that's really bad for business. I would say, though, truthfully, where we were so lucky was because we had just pivoted and were super small, we didn't have a big bank of existing clients that suddenly you go, the demand vanishes overnight and your revenues go to zero or near zero. That would actually be much harder for us now because, suddenly, you're factoring, you're like planning your business and you're thinking, okay, like we've got all the revenue coming in from our clients. If that went to zero now, that would be a real disaster. Whereas at the time it was quite good because two things happened. One, people in the industry actually started to have a lot more time to talk. So we were able to do so much research. At this stage, it was weird. We had a nice consumer product, but we knew nothing about the industry really still. So I remember we did weekly one-to-ones with people who worked at RMCs, just like learning about the industry. And that was, trust me, but I catch up with some of them now and she's like, God, I can't believe I was able to do that back then. I would never be able to do that now. So it was amazing for product development. And the second thing as time went on was we're a sort of a digital first solution and normally deliver services unaccompanied. And that became a lot more necessary, truthfully, during COVID. As people became able to move again, they didn't necessarily want to, there were still restrictions about how many people you could have and stuff like that. So digital services became a lot more palatable for what's a relatively traditional industry still. So yeah, we were quite lucky on two fronts really there.
I think that's what an interesting insight where, if you can survive throughout a downturn in the industry. I mean, this was a global pandemic, but even if it's something more localized or within a niche industry, if you can survive, I mean, to look at that as an opportunity to talk to people who have maybe more time on their hands or people who are, worst case scenario, laid off. And now perhaps, maybe you can hire them as a consultant just to learn, now you have all this opportunity to gain insight into an industry that all of a sudden had to hit the big pause button.
Yeah.
Really interesting, really interesting insight and probably something, a great reminder during recessions, during challenging times for businesses to say, look, keep the lights on and look forward, look ahead and take this as an exploratory time versus, time to worry.
Definitely. And definitely at the time we trimmed our burn as much as we could. We sort of got rid of our office straight away. Mm. We stopped doing all sorts of things. But there's always, goes back to that thought from earlier, there's always more options than you think, right? Mm. And it's just kind of, how do you take advantage of that? And not, it sounds terrible, so I shouldn't say
I know what you mean.
Take advantage of the fact that we didn't have any clients, shall we say.
Right, exactly. I mean, how do you turn a negative into a positive? And how do you sort of grow from
the best of a bad situation?
Yeah, and now you mentioned, obviously, and we all know this, that international borders were largely closed.
Yeah.
But of course, there was this large exodus out of, metropolitan areas. I mean, in New York City, that was the time when everyone was New York City's dead and all this stuff, prices outside of the city were inflated like crazy because everyone was moving. People were buying sort of country homes with cash at prices that no one had seen before. And I suspect this was happening in other parts of the country and the world. Did that have a positive impact on you at all? Were domestic moves due to COVID in the early days were actually helping you pick up some business?
Yeah, definitely, because our go-to-market basically became reaching out to people on LinkedIn, which is a recurring theme of everything we did. I absolutely love LinkedIn. So it's just you just reach out to anyone in the world. It's amazing. So anyway, we would just reach out to people and we'd say literally, oh, have you had employees request to relocate since the pandemic? And they often say yes, right? Because it's everyone was leaving New York or San Francisco. And because of the type of move that was, they would never support that. It didn't fit within typical parameters. And so we would then say, great, you don't even have to pay, just send them to us so we can get some reps. They can pay for us themselves if they want to. So that was an amazing headwind or tailwind for us to be like, oh, actually people are still moving. they're not moving, they're not like traditional corporate moves. And that was really when we started to think, wow, like, and learn, like, there's so many people relocating around the world that don't get any support. Can we support them? And the second thing with those domestic moves, which was quite useful for us, was most people couldn't even necessarily offer support because they were moving to places that people didn't traditionally move to, right? Like, most relocation providers are like great at moving people to New York or to San Francisco, but when it's like, oh yeah, so and so's moving to like the suburbs somewhere, shall we say, they couldn't really support. Whereas that was where having a sort of a tech first platform was really, really powerful, and stood us in very good stead, truthfully. So that was two strong tailwinds for us. And again, particularly when you're young and you're scrappy, you're like, we'll just take what we can get, yeah. We'll practice, we'll like, and then you start learning over time. And then now, at the time when we started, 100% of our business was B2B2C, where like the employee would end up paying for us. If the company would tell us that they're moving, but with the employee paying, you start practicing, you start improving your product, your processes, and then eventually your product becomes good enough to say, actually, okay, companies will pay for this now. And that's been a nice tailwind for us for sure.
That's awesome. That's really interesting. Yeah, so many lessons there, right? Especially for somebody who's early on in their entrepreneurial journey to take these opportunities to just grow and experiment and actually lean into how small and nimble you are versus, you know, a lot of companies say like, and I mean, we're probably guilty of this too, but a lot of very small companies are like, oh yeah, I'll talk to the board about this. You know, they have 15 email aliases to look as like they have a big team and it's all going to one person.
Yeah.
You know, but I think like I've always been pretty honest and open about this. Say, look, we're a small company. And the benefit of that is whatever you need, we can basically help you with it. We can make tweaks to the product. We can build new features out. We're more available in simpler ways in terms of support. And I think, yes, there will always be companies that say, okay, well, cool, but we only really work with very established companies. You know, fine. Maybe that's not your early adopter, but there are other companies that say, great, we need this. We don't have a solution. There's no other solution in the market. Yes, you're early, but we're going to use that to our benefit rather than look at that as a downside. And so I think actually being honest about that helps you find the right, especially early customers that will totally accept you for who you are and how you are and you kind of work with and partner with you as you grow rather than just be a quote unquote client.
Yeah. And that's the best thing. And sometimes I miss that. We're still at a stage where you can get that, but like not as much as in the early days where you're like, build this with us, like really be a partner, give feedback. And that was awesome. And just that's the other thing, when you come to a space and you speak to people in it, they're often excited that you're building something. Mm. And particularly if you're trying to solve a pain point that they are familiar with, they're like, oh yeah, like, you know, I want to help you solve this problem. That's amazing. And just so many like good friends from doing that, truthfully, people I still see and hang out with, which is like, yeah, really been a cool part of the whole experience. And that's such a benefit of being small and nimble and it does reduce as you grow.
That's all. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I mean, the early clients are the ones whose like phone numbers you have, and they'll just give you a call and say, "Hey, what about this?" And you're like, "Great, we're on it."
Yeah,
and, I love that. Those are really fun times.
Yeah,
and I think it's also for companies that are you know prospective clients who can see that they would know the advantage. I mean, it's only natural as a company grows for you to not be able to give that sort of attention to somebody unless they are truly an enterprise size client and they will pay you for that effort. Because in the beginning, you have more time than anything else. At this point, it's like, well, you've got clients, you have to support things. If you want me to take my chunk of my time, it's a natural progression of a business.
Yeah.
I love that. So I want to now, okay, great. So you've had this, you know, throughout an otherwise really difficult time in the world, really, you were able to provide a service that actually ended up being quite needed, which was wonderful, right? What a great, you know, if you want to call it luck or you want to call it, you know, whatever, what a great place to be in. Now, I know that in 2022, you guys raised a Series A of £8 million.
8 million would be great.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. £8 billion. You can build a rocket ship and fly out of here. No. See, so you raised interstellar relocation.
Exactly.
But you raised a Series A of £8 million. And I assume that was on the heels of, look, our product's growing, our platform's growing. We have this sort of momentum now of going from or potentially adding on to the B2B2C route, the additional just direct B2B route. Can you share a little bit about that? And maybe, you know, specifically, like, when did you decide, all right, we should raise some funds?
Yeah, I'll actually probably jump back even one more because I think it's a bit more instructive in the sense of, so we did our first like corporate relocation in June of 2020, a chap called Luigi from Italy to Ireland, and we'll never forget it. And then throughout the second half of 2020, as we could, we started to grow quite a lot and through consumers, like B2B2C. And then we started to get into stage like, okay, we're growing. There's clearly something here. And then it was really a stage where we knew that we could do so much more with our product, but truthfully, we couldn't afford to hire engineers at the time because, you know, we weren't making enough to do it. So we were like, actually, like, the premise of what we're doing seems to, we're getting great feedback. We were building like great relationships. We could move so much faster if we had more capital to raise. And so that was when we decided to raise, did a 2 million seed in January 2021. Similarly, last year it was, okay, we were growing relatively nicely. And I think both times it was like, we're growing nicely and we're bumping up to the point where you could clearly see where you could spend additional money. And I think that was the time where it was like, wow, okay, like, particularly for this raise, it was like we could hire way more, we could be way more aggressive with sales and marketing, we could hire way more engineers, which is what we've mainly focused on. We're like, okay, there's clearly a huge market here, which is definitely something that investors care about. Like, millions of people are relocating and they're like, that excites them. There's clearly some traction. People are like semi-interested in what we're doing. If we raise more cash, then we could actually start, you know, building towards that market. And particularly for us, because we had that B2B2C background, we were sort of sharing that so many people don't get support when they're relocating or just get cash. We were sort of sharing, actually, there is a middle ground between like a traditional expat package and nothing. You can use PerchPeak and it will be a great experience. And that was when we decided, actually, we're capping out here. Let's raise some additional cash so we can go even faster.
And so, I mean, I guess from a capital perspective, a capital raise perspective is because you obviously have to sell something. You have to sell a big vision, right, to investors. It's not a loan that they're expecting you to pay back.
This is exactly.
A piece of the company for a future kind of quite big returns, which, you know, comes with its pluses or minuses. There's pressure, right?
I mean, you have to
go big, and which is great. I mean, to have that really kind of behind you. But I'm curious, what is the goal here? What is the vision? And I mean, and no one's going to hold you to this, you know. We know that companies pivot and move, and you kind of go sometimes where the market takes you. But is the idea that you will be kind of the one-stop shop for, you know, the global mobility market? Is it like, what are your thoughts on, like, what is the big vision that other companies in this industry can look at?
Yeah, I think for us, we tried to stay quite true for this of, we want to build the best platform for helping anyone relocate anywhere, with the like little side caveats that we don't do visas and taxes, right? Like, actually, because there's a whole circle of this, but hypothetically, they're not like, anyway, we have great partners who can help us with that. And I think really for us, and this is the key insight, and this is driven by our own personal experience, is that the vast majority of people relocating don't get any support, and so are having a hugely stressful time. And in investor meetings, I would just ask people, like, have you relocated before? And if they say yes, you go like, what was your experience like? And typically they've done it by themselves and it was stressful. So it's like, it's kind of quite like a clear, like, wouldn't it be cool if, regardless of whether you're moving to Seattle or Sao Paulo or Singapore, there's one platform where you can go in and you're told exactly what you need to do, when you need to do it, what other people did. And when you get stuck, you can get your relocation expert to dig you out of a hole and make sure you have a great experience. And I think that's where, for us, two things are really important for that. One is being global and being able to help people move to lots of markets. And two is being affordable and not, which is kind of, and this is something that being at Amazon was great for, is like, customers want low prices, that doesn't mean you're a bad business. Sometimes businesses are like, how do we just increase prices as much as possible? For us, it's like, how do we make our product as affordable as possible, but still deliver immense value to the person relocating? And that's really where, if we can keep executing on building that platform, I think, yeah, we're in a good place, because the sort of traditional global mobility industry has been a little bit more centered on traditional expats or assignees. And we're sort of sitting there saying, that's great, we can help them. But what about everyone else who's just having this really stressful experience? Do they not deserve some support in their harrowing time? And that's been quite, and we love speaking, you know, like we love speaking about, okay, great, you have graduates, or you have employees that want to go and work remotely. You have employees that get a lump sum, or they just get shipping, or, you know, they're still having quite a fragmented journey. We love being like, right, give them access to PerchSpeak and we'll look them up. Well, that's the theory anyway. Some days are better than others, but generally I think it's going okay.
I mean, listen, from all the trends that I've seen, you know, number one, early career professionals are trying to travel more than before. And to your point, the companies, it's not feasible to handhold every early career employee, but many, you know, I'm a sort of middle to late older millennial,
yeah.
You know, and sort of, and millennials and Gen Zs are, I think, consistently polling to say that they want to have experiences abroad as part of their job. I mean, I was one of those people. I joined after I left, first of all, in immigration law, stupidly, I was like, well, great, my clients are all over the world, I'm sure they're going to be able to travel. Yeah. But obviously, they're not. Well, I'm not traveling anywhere. They're trying to come to the US.
Yeah.
And then I worked at a fintech company here in New York after I left the legal practice and before I launched Laborless. We had offices. I mean, the company has offices in other parts of the world. I guess I probably could have pushed more. I had some colleagues that had some global, but none of my projects required me to move. And, you know, it never felt that I could even ask anyone. It felt to me that if I said, hey, can I just go work from the London office or the Mumbai office, they'd be like, no. You know, I mean, sure, if you want to go on vacation there and pay for everything yourself, and we could allow you to get your key card in and see the office, but there was no meaningful way for me to do that. And I wanted to, and I never felt it. I had to really start my own. The first time I ever traveled for work was for my own business.
Wow. You know?
And so it was such a moment for me to think, wow, I'm finally doing it. But of course, the thinking is, if you work for a company that has global offices and you can do your job remotely, why not have that option? And so I think having a middle ground in terms of, you know, they can sort of self-manage it and it's at a lower cost, regardless of who pays for it. I love this idea of having a platform that supports that. So that's number one. That's the first trend that I see where I think a company like PerchSpeak makes sense and has the ability to grow. Number two, just last week, the guest on our show was are building a platform that helps digital nomads, you know, apply or folks apply for digital nomad visa. A lot of those people are freelancers and just but there's a growing number of corporate employees that go to their company and they say, look, I can go work in Portugal or Greece or Costa Rica. You don't have to have an office there. I can go there for legally with the digital nomad visa. All I need is just a little bit of support. And so they may say, like, okay, this one's on you because you want to. Yeah. We'll allow it because we want to keep you. And we know, you know, we know the benefits of sort of working remotely, being in another country, but we can't support you with a full package.
Yeah.
And so similarly, like the trend is towards something that is more cost effective and allows people to travel around the world and work there.
It is, and I think that's one for us. It's like for us, it doesn't really matter whether we're helping someone move for an office-based job, move because they want to work remotely, move because they, you know, just have us to move, but it is going to be a mix of office and in person. Like for us, it's like, if you're moving from A to B, we can help you. I think what we see is the barrier to relocation is going down. As you said, so many people have wanted to do this historically, but it's only really been forward thinking, mega global corporates like Amazon that could have these huge mobility programs, because you have to really have the infrastructure to make it happen. Whereas now, as you say, like almost not regardless of the firm, but people want to live and work in different countries, sometimes permanently, sometimes for less time, but the cat is a little bit out of the bag, and that's where obviously bias, but more people will relocate than previously, and hopefully we're in good shape to try and help you that. Touch wood anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm biased at that because I come from the immigration side. And so my focus is always on the visa service.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Like, as I've said this in a number of conversations, as an immigration lawyer, you know, we kind of are, for international moves, like the kind of barrier to the move. If there's no visa, there's no move, right?
Exactly.
But for us, it's like, great, the visa's done, next case.
Exactly.
We don't think about, or at least I, as a junior level attorney, was never even told to think about, like, hey, look at what happens afterwards, after they get the visa. And that's really where the journey starts for them, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. But that's the assignee or the person relocating. They're like, oh, great, and now I can go. That's when all the other stuff comes in. And that's why immigration companies are such great partners for us, because it's like, if you can figure out, like, the handover is just kind of perfect for us to be like, okay, great, now you've done, we'll look after you for the rest of it. But it is funny how, like, you get in your lanes, and, like, because there are great companies that work even further downstream than us, and they're like, because we get people from A to B, get them settled, then there's like huge community building downstream, then there's people focusing on like repatriate, like there's like all these different aspects, but it's a big industry at the end of the day.
Exactly. Elena Anderson says, I love to hear about the focus on early career professionals. Totally. And it'll add so much value to their employment experience. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think it's great that corporates are finally, you know, kind of seeing this more and more, and are opening their eyes to allocating resources, because it's easy to say, well, no, this person's really early in their career, we don't want to invest thousands of dollars into their move. Like, but, you know, it's also if they leave because they're not able to get that opportunity, you're going to spend way more money trying to recruit somebody else, right? Or why wouldn't you want to make somebody who's otherwise a great employee happy and you know, give them the opportunity, and they can, that builds loyalty, you know, especially people always, you know, as the millennials, we were the butt of every joke about like, you know, you jump around every 2 years. Well, you know what? I always thought that society is going to look back, at least in America, North America, at millennials, and say that we kind of forced the issue of, okay, we went too hard with the free lunch every day and the yoga every single day and all that. Okay, we've toned that down a little bit, but the point was, we want to be happier at work. We want to feel that work is more aligned with our life than just a cubicle. And so I think we're seeing the net effect of that today. So, Paul, I know we've had it's been a wonderful conversation. I do want to ask you one last question before we jump. What's Perch Peak? Where did that name come from? And tell me a little bit about the name and the logo, which is, as you mentioned before, it's a colorful, I guess, a parrot, right?
A parrot, exactly. So we have a few different versions, but this guy's the official logo. Where is it? Oh, I'm such an idiot. I'm such a moron. I can't believe I just did that. I was
like, you're just looking at the wrong side of your shirt.
I'm like literally the biggest idiot. But something we glossed over in the early days of Perch Peak was that we weren't actually founded as Perch Peak. Believe it or not, we were founded initially as Easy Peasy Renting, because we were...
I love it.
I know.
I'm not going to lie. I wish you were still Easy Peasy Anything is the best name.
I know. I was loving it. But anyway, then at some point we, like fairly fast, like we were like, okay, fine, not Easy Peasy. I was like, I loved it. And then we went for quite a corporate name of Let's Step. And then we were like, okay, if we're going to be building this business for like 20 years or however long, like more, hopefully, I love the space, like let's have a fun name. And so then we just wanted to have one that we could have an animal as the logo. So then we said like parrots are great, and then we started just riffing off like, okay, what would tangentially be related, and then we're like, we'd heard somewhere that names with a K in it are easier to remember, no offense to labelers, but we were like let's just have some fun. And actually, that's been one of those things that you do early on and you look back and would have been easy not to do, but wow, it's been so key for our like branding, our values, our like how we operate, obviously our merchandise as well, but Perch Merch. But yeah, it's just been one of the best decisions we made, was to change the name to Perch Peak.
So let me ask you then, what does Perch Peak mean to you?
Yeah, so I think it's funny, because at the start it was like, oh, you know, perch is like a home and peaking is like looking for it. I think now, and it's funny, as we've grown, I think probably the two things we try and toe the line of are like being empathetic, but having fun and achieving great performance, which comes back to kind of the sports, like sports teams growing up, of just like, how do you try and achieve that like elite performance and that atmosphere where like the team is the sum of more than the parts. And for me, I think that the key elements are like people care about what they're doing. And that's one of the best things about this whole industry is like people are passionate about it, which is awesome. I'm not sure I could go back to an industry where people aren't like passionate, if that makes sense. But then the second thing is just like having fun, right? Like you spend most of your working day, well, for waking day with colleagues or like chatting virtually to them, like have a good time doing it and show empathy to them. So that's what Perch Beat stands for now for me, but I don't know what others would say. They probably be just like Paul telling rubbish jokes or something like that.
I love it. No, that's great. I mean, it evolves, you know, our names evolves, evolve with the business. And I think the idea too, that your logo is a bird, and which obviously signifies migration to some extent. And the fact that it's colorful to me, at least, is kind of fun.
Mate. And colorful is so fun. It's a nightmare for our designers. They're like, why do we have such a colorful logo? That sucks. But outside of that, they're like, it's great.
That's awesome. Well, Paul, thank you so much. This is such a great conversation. I really love what you guys are doing. Congrats on all your success so far. And best of luck, I think, as the world continues to shift in the direction we're seeing it go. I suspect that the need for your service will only grow. So looking forward to following and the progress and watching where you guys go.
Thanks, man. It's great to get introduced properly. And thanks for having me on. Absolutely, cheers, buddy.
Cheers. Thank you.